That's so against everything that America is and stood for hundreds of years.
Building out a more decentralized
and socioeconomic background, religious beliefs.
Empower people to help themselves.
This is Decentralized.
This week, we're joined by Joey Krug of Augur. But first, we've got some really exciting news. Just this week, the Edward Snowden documentary, Citizen 4, has won an Oscar for Best Documentary. I think this is fantastic. The fact that this documentary has made it out into the public, a lot of people have seen it, and it's getting such recognition as an Oscar. I believe this is the highest award in the film industry. Tony, you've seen this. What did you think of the film?
It was awesome. It was probably one of the three best documentaries I've ever seen in my life. And most people know the story already, so that's one thing. But what the documentary really shows you is what he's doing in the hotel room as it's leaking and as he's becoming this, you know, globally known figure for the leak. And going on about why, you know, how he's talking to Greenwald, the people that he's talking with, why he's doing this. It is fantastic. And, you know, I could see this being lost on some who may not enjoy this type of documentary, because it is very much like, this is what's happening right now. And there's not as much storytelling, because the story, I think, has already been told. This is more behind the scenes of how that came to happen. And I just can't say enough about how good it was, and how gripping it was. There, of course, you know, my favorite band was in doing all the music for, it was a Nine Inch Nails soundtrack, so I thought that fit perfectly well. That is the music I would exactly want to hear in this documentary, so, you know, that scored major points for me. The only fault I had in it, and this is not in the movie, it's actually in the distribution, is it was a pain in the ass to see. They really took it on a very limited theater run, like a lot of independent films and documentaries do. And, you know, they did one show here in Atlanta, and it sold out, I believe, pretty quickly, so I couldn't go. I had to wait to go to find other means to watch it, which sucks, because I actually wanted to support this. And I hope I can support this, because I want to pay for it and get a legitimate copy. But I did want to see it extremely bad. So, you know, as soon as I could, I did. And I think that's one of those things where, as this becomes easier to find and see for people, they're going to watch this, and they're going to go, okay, it might change some minds for people that saw him and as, you know, someone who basically sympathized with Russians, just people that don't understand the story. They'll watch this and they'll go, okay, I think his motivation was pretty pure. And it really comes across that way. And can't recommend it enough. I'm a big documentary fan. And if I'm putting it in my top three, I put that very high. I couldn't rate it as my favorite, but that's because I have sentimental favorites. But documentaries are pretty much the only genre of film that I really enjoy watching to a great extent. So I recommend it. I thought it was going to win, and it won. So I'm very happy for it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think this documentary, I've seen parts of it. I haven't finished it just yet. But it really highlights, for a lot of the people who are missing out the nuances of sort of the whole discussion around, you know, national state surveillance and individual citizen privacy and the violation of the law by the government and no accountability of the government for violating the law. It really highlights the purest perspective here. And I think it will bring to light, and it will clarify, bring a lot of people back over to realize that this discussion is about something a lot more than, you know, just blind nationalism and blind support of your state. Statism, I view it as a religion, right? In that a lot of people who belong to that sort of organization have been born into it, right? They sort of have inherited their views and their beliefs and their perspectives. It's not that they've thought through independently or elected themselves into believing these things. Is that they just sort of have grown up in a society where, in the case of nationalism and specifically the United States, it's just so natural for them to, yeah, you know, support your country because it's the right thing to do, and you don't necessarily start questioning. And this video, this documentary, I think, really shows what true heroism is, in that, you know, it is the truest patriot is one that, you know, questions his government, right? Not one that blindly supports it. And that is the very reason that, you know, America originally was created, And this is sort of this anti sort of authoritarian feel kind of goes away as you realize how deep this discussion goes, and that it's a question of individual liberty, not so much of, you know, oh, this is just a, you know, a terrorist. He's a, you know, a violator, an anti-state person. No, it's much more nuanced than that, and I think this documentary does an extremely good job of pointing out what those nuances and that those deep philosophical questions are.
Yeah, that's a great point, Eric, and I didn't have the good fortune of seeing Citizen 4, but I've watched Edward Snowden and seen sort of this story unfold with a lot of interest, and I think we can all see in him, and especially in the things like this documentary, this is someone with an immense amount of emotional and moral courage for his age. I think he's in his mid-20s, and he clearly really understands individual liberty very well. And I actually had the good fortune of seeing him at the International Students for Liberty conference in D.C. last weekend. He actually joined us via Google Hangout, of all things, and gave a great talk on sort of heroism and sort of how to be heroic in defending the things, you know, you believe in, you care about. And he was very self-effacing, somewhat even awkward, but also really eloquent and forthright about what he cared about, what he believed in. This is a very philosophical guy, and it takes a philosophical guy to do the things he's done. So I'm very interested to see how the perception of Snowden changes over time. Obviously, I think he's becoming, with things like this Oscar and things like his Reddit AMA today, people are seeing him one-on-one. They aren't being filtered, having their experience of him filtered through the media as much. They're kind of seeing what he's like as a person. And if he's anything like, you know, how he's portrayed in this film, people like Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, who also were sort of stars of this film and producers of this film, what they've done and what they've displayed. He's certainly an individual to be remarked upon as really an influential one in this early 21st century.
Yeah, and, you know, I think there's also more to it than that. And when, you know, he discussed his motivations, I remember him saying something, this was in an interview a year or so back, that it was because he grew up loving the internet and the information it brought to him. And, you know, he really felt that this was important, and that's really why he did it. And I think, I don't think it makes as much of a case for liberty as it does for true transparency. And I'm a big fan, if you're going to have a government, of it being 100% transparent. I mean, all recording, if you are getting paid on the government's dime, every recording, every minute of your life, public and private, should be recorded, and that should be a part of your contract with whatever to take that job. And yeah, you sacrifice personal privacy to serve in that role if you're going to do that. I'm a big fan of that. That's the way I've kind of always thought, and you know, I think that that's a goal that could happen, not soon, but it could. And I think that really is the dialogue that he wants to promote. I don't know that, but it seems like it, and, you know, it promoted it, but I remember the funniest thing that happened, and we were talking about his age, James, as soon as this happened, everything was, he is a spoiled millennial that just thinks of himself, and, you know, he did this just taking it on, he didn't go through the proper channels, which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Do you think in a million years, if he went through the proper channels, this would have ever gotten out? Look what happened today in Chicago with what happens with their black site. The Chicago police have a black site in the city of Chicago, and these are this is very much a municipal thing. This is not a federal or an international thing, and that's happening. And you know, obviously, someone could have reported it. Do you think we would have ever found out? Absolutely not. Leaks are important, super important, and you know, I think they are much more important than confidentiality.
Well, what's interesting here is, you know, what's being brought to the public dialogue is exactly the methods that the NSA is using to spy on its citizens. And just recently, there was the SIM card hack, this company Gemalto. A good portion, a significant majority, actually, of the SIM cards that are being distributed around the world apparently are completely vulnerable. And I've talked about this before. This is like, you know, one of the bigger uses of this by a non-government organization. But if this is just becoming a zero day in the public, and you damn well better believe that the NSA and the CIA GCHQ have been aware of this for quite some time, how long have they been using this exploit with or without the company's, not the sort of distributor's knowledge, and with or without the people's knowledge? How much data are they collecting? And I find it how many other exploits are there, right? You can start going through all of the what Greenwald has posted and all the content they've selected out of Edward Snowden's documents, and the scope of this is just utterly massive. They are literally collecting every single document, every single communication about every citizen. It's such a wide net.
That wide net, I think, is actually a part of their failure. And to me, that's actually, I hate to say this, and it sounds bad, but it actually gives me some relief and some, like, whew, I'm a little less anxiety, just because, you know, there's that much data. And, you know, if there's that much data, there's much more to go through, and that's why, basically, they don't find the things they want to find, because they're not basically, you know, targeting the people they want. They're getting everything, and if you're getting everything, it's much harder to find. You have to have much better algorithms. You have to have much better data collection abilities, and much more, you know, actual people to go through it and sort it. So, you know, I think there's a lot there. I've lived my entire teenage to adult life assuming every single moment of my life is recorded. And people think, oh, that's sad, and I go, no, it's not at all. It's actually kind of, you know, to me it's liberating, but to me it's also like, it's just the way I am, and, you know, I don't necessarily, none of these things surprise me, let me put it that way. I didn't know they were happening, but they don't surprise me.
Yeah, I think what's striking here is that a lot of people do assume that they have private communications. You know, the built-in devices that get distributed by your carrier, you buy on some market, and then you go buy a SIM card for it, you assume that you're safe. I think the biggest thing to point out here is that the defaults are simply insecure. Whether we agree with, you know, you, Tony, and that we should just live everything as if we were being recorded, I think that's an unfortunate way to live. Like, I challenge myself to live that way because it forces me to make decisions that I would be proud of in the future. But it's just a total violation of privacy. So I think now is a good time to sort of talk about some alternatives to some of the things that we have by default that we might take for granted as being secure but aren't. Some of the things like basic encryption of text messages. You may not realize it, but when you send an SMS, no matter what service it is, at the carrier level, your service provider has full access to your text messages. They are completely unencrypted over the wire. It's as insecure as basic email, right? So one thing I would strongly recommend is Moxie Marlin Spike's company, Open Whisper Systems, produces a software called Text Secure. It allows us to do something very similar to PGP with email. In fact, it's way even easier. That is Text Secure, and that will allow basically key exchange with anybody you want to text message, and even the carrier cannot decrypt your messages. So that's very exciting. On phone calls, I'm not a big phone user. Tony, I think you might have a little more insight into how we can secure phone calls.
Yes, well, the truth is, I don't know if you really can. There's always baseband hacks, but what you can do is you could use something like Silent Circle, which also has text message encryption. The problem that I have with it, and this is, of course, a problem with encryption, is that both parties need to be using it. You know, it is a subscription service, and, you know, you have to pay for it, but it does encrypt, you know, your voice and your text messages. These things came basically in, they came as default with the Black phone that's for sale, which, you know, actually recently got hacked. No surprise there. That's my issue, is no matter how good your encryption is, there's just still vulnerabilities. And also, you know, there's also the fact that, I guess just, how much are they going to look for, and does the encryption make you a bigger target? And I think it does. I'm very, very positive of that using encryption makes you a bigger target. But I think more people are using it, so it may work out to the benefit of everyone.
Of course, we talked a little bit about the EFF and their move to encrypt everything, which makes it impossible to single people out. If everything is encrypted by default, then there is no way to single people out. And I think that's what we have to move towards. But as you're talking about phone services, I was reminded that Open Whisper Systems also produces Redphone, which is built by the same people as TechSecure, and it is full end-to-end encryption. It actually encrypts your data before it hits baseband, so even at the baseband level, it is encrypted. So, Redphone and TechSecure, and that is encrypted phone communications and text messages.
I think another avenue to approach this from, and there are a lot of good apps out there, but a really good root basis vulnerability that this NSA and GHQ targeted were servers, which Gemalto was holding the encryption keys for their phones on. So the encryption keys for these SIM cards were very easy to target because of their centralized nature. Sort of moving towards serverless systems is obviously a longer-term goal, but sort of eliminating those central points of failure will be definitely very important in the long term for removing these vulnerabilities, and also possibly exploring open source hardware, phones, you know, alternatives to SIM cards, or yeah, I think Eric is mentioning talks as well as sort of a video call alternative. Anything like that that doesn't have those vulnerabilities baked into it, and that the average user can have the most control over as possible. Obviously, open source hardware is a bit outside of everyone's comfort zone for the most part, so definitely going with apps like these or like one I particularly like is Telegram, also great alternative to this problem. So this is definitely a concerning issue, but speaking of communications really and even bigger problems with data, we have an FCC decision coming this Thursday on net neutrality, which is going to affect sort of a much larger, more important channel of data, which is the internet. Net neutrality, of course, being generally the idea that all data should be treated equally by ISPs and by companies. And the FCC is proposing that these companies be regulated now as Title II carriers, that they be regulated as utility companies in order to maintain this in the face of some lobbying opposition from companies like Comcast and Verizon. What do y'all think about the principle of net neutrality? It's obviously been embraced by a lot of defenders of the internet, by EFF. Do you think this is an important issue, and do you think the FCC's proposal is going to be the best way to ensure that?
Yeah, so net neutrality is an absolute fundamental need for the internet and humanity as a whole to succeed and be carried on into the next generation of technological improvement. However, net neutrality with a capital N, with two capital N's as a line item in a law or a regulation is absolutely the wrong way to go here. And I'll provide the dichotomy of arguments. Net neutrality is important because you shouldn't be able to a necessary third party should not be able to prioritize at their own whim one type of traffic over another. This is important to eliminate censorship. This is important to provide freedom of speech on the internet. For example, if Comcast decided that, you know, in some whimsical world, they decided they wanted to throttle YouTube because it competes with their cable service, they should not be allowed to do that. That should be against their terms. Or it should be beaten out by the markets. And that's the second side of the argument. The other side of the argument is that, well, if you net neutrality is a bad thing because you want a free market and you want these services to be forced to compete with one another on their quality and consistency of service. I always stray away from government regulation, and I think that this Title II utility categorization is going to be extremely harmful, but at least it raises the dialogue. I am afraid, however, that it will quelch the demand for true net neutrality and true and free and open markets in internet providers. I mean, you think about the basics of this are they're going to try regulating internet as if it's a utility. Now, how many of you out there, of our listeners, are happy with your utility companies? Like, really, think about this. You do not want your internet regulated as a utility company. What you do want is you want providers who are capable of providing good service being allowed into the market to disrupt and improve the quality of service across the board, force these scumbags to compete on a fair and equal level.
I disagree. Now this is my personal anecdotal truth on here, but I would much rather deal with a utility company than Comcast or Verizon. I think that government serves a very limited role, but I think it's important, and I think classifying the internet as a utility is interesting and maybe the right thing to do, But I also think we have to go back, you know, how many years from when the FCC was really formed and why it existed, right? The FCC existed, and it existed for a good reason. And this is a good example of why government gets bloated over time and really good ideas that are necessary become useless. It existed to designate licenses for certain spectrums of wavelength, so there was no, you know, there was no real cross, you know, degradation of a signal, right? So I just can't start a TV channel from my house because it would interrupt with the TV stations that are broadcasting locally, right? So then it goes, who owns the airwaves? Same thing here. Who owns the internet? Really no one. So if no one owns the internet, how do we regulate that? And I don't mean regulate in a governmental sense, but how do we regulate who provides the service and how we get it? The private market's an ideal place, but the scope of how you get access is really not good. I'm from Detroit. The city of Detroit has so many people that don't have any kind of access to the internet. I know recently Snyder, the governor there, said that they were going to give access to, he was going to bring something in that had access to fiber for the first time in Michigan. But the lack of internet access in that city proves that this private market isn't working. I think there are limited uses for government. I'm a very limited government thing. I think maybe there's 5 to 10 things they should do, and by strictly regulated, I mean on a pure democratic system of voting. That's it. Designating spectrum is important, and the other thing that's important is ensuring that people have as cheap as possible access to the internet. And I think that in general, the utilities do okay, better than the communication companies and the telecom companies we have right now.
Generally speaking, utility providers tend to be monopolies. I don't think that's generally a good thing for either access or pricing. And imposing something like net neutrality, it's essentially a price control for the internet, saying we're going to abolish prices in internet data. And I think that's going to be a serious problem, especially as the internet becomes more widely used. And I think it's actually contrary to maybe what's popularly proposed by people like the EFF, which I absolutely love the EFF. But it's almost inhumane to remove the information that prices give us for the best uses of a resource, like the internet. And saying that necessarily all data has to be treated the same or can't be priced differently, it's something I like to explore more, but it's questionable. And I think in general, having a price control like that's going to produce shortages rather than abundances. And utilities are regulations of utilities definitely not the right way to increase access and increase competition.
I definitely understand.
Sorry?
I hate to interrupt, but as you say this, James, I wonder maybe this is a play to prevent Google from entering the market. Maybe this is like an underhanded play. If internet access was a utility, Google Fiber probably would not exist. Think about that.
But it barely exists now. It exists in a few cities, and the main reason it exists in a few cities is really because they see what's happening in like Japan and how great their internet access is. We're severely lacking. It's like, how far behind are we here? And that's why. And Eric, I don't actually disagree with you. I think this could be something to prevent Google from coming in that industry. I totally think that could be it. But I don't necessarily know, you know, the answer here, right? I don't think there is a clear answer right now. And I think it really has to do with who owns the right to transfer information. And the internet is not a wavelength thing. It's wireless, but you know, for fiber it isn't. And it does involve laying cable. It involves physical things need to happen, right? And you know, there was a time in America where we didn't have roads, and you know, government provided those roads. There's very limited things I think they can do, and this may be one of them. But I don't necessarily know if it's the answer. I could be very wrong here. I don't have the answer. I think that's the most important thing I want people to come away with here, is at least I don't have the answer.
Just to be clear, the first roads were private roads. The government didn't come in until much, much later. But who will build the roads anyways?
I would say the same about the internet, honestly. I mean, this is something where the most revolutionary technologies, the decentralized ones, the ones that are making the internet free, are the ones being made by individuals and groups outside of the government. And I think Tony's very much right in saying that we don't know the answer to this, whether net neutrality is a good thing or a bad thing in principle, what the best way to ensure that would be. And that in mind, I do think it's generally good to look into how can we approach this incrementally and experimentally? And that's being done by those individuals and groups outside of the government, things like mesh networking or peer-to-peer streaming, like things even Netflix is exploring with sort of this news of the changes in net neutrality ruling. So there's a lot of exploration to be done, and I think a lot of exciting developments. We'll know soon what the FCC's decision is, and we'll know probably much later what the actual effect of it is. But
I want to correct you on one thing. The origins of the internet do come from governmental programs. ARPANET, DARPA, yes, they were involved with universities, but they were funded by government programs, much like Tor. and that doesn't that make you kind of think? But anyways, just wanted to clarify that too.
I would say that, and I think you're absolutely right, the actual uses of the internet for things other than communications on when to bomb the Russians, communications on anything actually useful to people were basically pioneered by academics and individuals outside of the government. So I understand what you're saying, but I think the solutions which, you know, at least we're generally going to value as people who oppose power and centralization are going to be outside of that. So I am very skeptical still, and I think I agree with Eric here, of claims by the FCC to be actually protecting individuals against concentrated power, particularly when the FCC chairman is, you know, very much embedded and has a very embedded past in that industry, in those cable providers. So, but it's definitely very interesting. I think it's a really important issue. But I think we should go ahead and transition over to our interview with Joey Krug. We're going to talk about a decentralized platform, which is maybe bringing a little bit more hope to this very centralized world, and something, Tony, I know you're very passionate about, the Augur Project. So let's begin our interview.
Hey, everyone. Well, we would like to welcome Joey Krug from Augur here on the podcast. How are you doing today, Joey?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing awesome. It's an honor to be a part of this project, and you know, this is our second week of having someone from Augur, and after that we're going to slow down on it, but I was good to join the team, so I wanted to get, you know, you on next to really talk about it. And I think, you know, the best way to start is to start off with your interest in decentralized technology and what you did in the past that led you to this moment.
Yeah, so I first started getting involved with decentralized technology with, I guess technically BitTorrent was the first thing I was involved with. Just as like a user, but then in 2011 I got involved with Bitcoin, and I basically saw this forum post that said, you know, make money with your GPU, and I thought it seemed like BS, and so I ignored it for about 6 weeks, and it was still the top post on this forum called overclock.net, to basically make your computer run faster than it's supposed to. And so anyway, I found about Bitcoin there, kind of got involved with the community then, bought a few Bitcoin when it was $20 at from Mt. Gox, and then like the day later, Gox got hacked and the price dropped to $5. So I kind of ignored it for a while, and then back in 2013, I noticed that the community, like for in-store use, it wasn't really there. I thought maybe a point of sale might help with that. Made a point of sale that allows you to basically do stuff with Bitcoin using sound and Bluetooth Low Energy. And then after that, this one of my friends, he basically called me up and said he was working on this project to allow you to bet on altcoins. And I thought it was kind of stupid, so I just ignored it. And then about a month later, he called me up again and said, hey, we pivoted to this project. It's called Truthcoin. It was the precursor to Augur, basically. And it allows you to basically buy and sell shares and outcomes of anything, which immediately piqued my interest. I started looking into it, and then about a few days later, I was like, yeah, I absolutely want to be a part of this. And he referred me to Jack, who was their tech guy, and he interviewed me to see if I'd be a good fit with the tech team, and I started that week.
So Joey, what was it about the Augur project and about Truthcoin that really fascinated you and drew you to work with them?
So it basically involved this concept called prediction markets, which almost everybody knows what they are, but nobody's actually heard the term. So, and I had never heard the term before this project either. And a prediction market is basically any market where there's one or more outcomes. And so you ask a question, and there could be like a yes, it happened, or no, it didn't happen. Or it could be a question about, like, you know, will the price of this this thing be greater than X or less than X at a certain date. And you basically buy and sell shares in these outcomes. And so decentralizing that tech seemed pretty interesting to me because I looked into it and there used to be a prediction market called Entrade, but it got shut down in 2013 because they ignored some of the CFTCs, which is the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. They ignored some of their rules until they ended up getting shut down. And so I realized that a decentralized prediction market could be very powerful.
Awesome. Can you talk to us a little about what those regulations generally entail? So, and then maybe segue into, you know, how do you differentiate, you know, between your compliance model and sort of like what some of these other companies have done?
Yeah, so what they entail is basically what Entrade got in trouble for was you're not allowed to speculate on commodities. And so Entrade had these markets where you could speculate on the price of oil. And the CFTC asked them in 2005, I believe, to stop. And they actually did. But then back in the end of 2012, Entrade's CEO decided he didn't care. And he basically allowed these markets again. And a year later, the CFTC says, well, we're going to file suit against you, and we're going to freeze your bank assets. And so that pretty much, you know, screwed up the company. They couldn't afford to operate because their banks were frozen. And so what we do instead is we say, well, we're not actually going to operate these markets. It's basically all going to be done on a decentralized code base in Ethereum. And in Entrade, they had an order book, which is basically where you say, I'll buy this share for $5, and someone else says, I'll sell for $6, and you meet in the middle and probably end up doing a transaction around $5.50. With our system, instead, you buy from an equation. So that's another thing that, you know, all the CFTC's laws apply to people actually operating order books, actually operating the markets, and we do none of that.
Excellent. So you're mentioning you're doing Augur on top of Ethereum, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So as sort of like a tech guy, can you go ahead and give us a little bit of detail about Ethereum and then how Augur is going to actually be incorporated into Ethereum? Like, talk to us about the architecture.
Yeah, so Ethereum's pretty interesting because it starts with, you know, the blockchain model that Bitcoin has. But what Bitcoin does is they store all the data in each block. So let's say I want to do a transaction. All that transaction data is stored in that block. Now, what Ethereum does, it says, let's take all of our data and let's store it in a separate file. We'll call it, say, the data file. And so you have this data file, and the Ethereum blockchain instead records modifications to the data. So instead of having to store all the data in the blocks, you just store the modifications, and it allows you to basically have a lot more capabilities, but a lot less data usage, so you don't have blockchain bloat. And then the other cool part of Ethereum is you basically can – one second. I got to exit a window. I'm getting a bunch of messages on Slack. Okay. And so the other cool thing about Ethereum is you can run code on it. So Bitcoin, you know, you can do financial transactions, but that's pretty much it. If I have an arbitrary piece of code I want to run, I can't do it on Bitcoin. And so that's why we went with Ethereum. Now, there is another project called Counterparty who took some of Ethereum's stuff and said, you know, we're going to allow you to use these features. The problem with Counterparty is there's a few problems. One, you can't use Bitcoin in it, in the contracts. I mean, you can use Bitcoin on Counterparty, but you can't actually use it involved with the code. And so you can't do that, and you also can't issue Counterparty assets from the code. And we need one of those to be able to operate our platform. Ethereum does provide both of those possibilities, so that's why we're going with Ethereum.
That sort of leads into my next question, actually, really well. And I'm wondering, as a developer, what do you find to be some of the limitations of blockchain technology as far as what you're working with, what you're building? Are there bugs to decentralization, or do you think it's something that can be overcome and something that can be improved upon?
So I'd say the biggest issue with blockchain technology when it comes to, say, like, you know, what we're doing running this arbitrary code on Ethereum is it's very expensive. And the other problem is you can't run anything that's obfuscated. So let's say you want to run some code and you want to keep something secret. It's almost impossible to do right now. There's people working on it, but the solutions aren't super far in. and nobody's really figured out how to do it yet. It's sort of called the Holy Grail of cryptography. By Vitalik calls it that. Some people call it moon math. But basically, the idea is, can we make a way to basically run some arbitrary code and prove that you ran it with a certain set of inputs and prove that it outputted a certain result while keeping all that information secret? And currently, blockchains can't do that. If they could, you'd be able to do a ton of more stuff.
So this is like bleeding into zero-knowledge proofs in cryptography, right?
Yep.
So I believe there are zero-knowledge proofs mathematically, and a lot of the challenge is that they're computationally intensive. Is that a rough estimate of where things are at?
Yeah, that's about it. You know, they're pretty hard to compute, and so like, even if you were to use one of the ones that existed, it's cheaper to just run all the code. The ideal, you know, quote unquote holy grail of it is get it so it's very cheap to compute. And that way you can run all this very complicated code that would cost you, you know, $100 to run on Ethereum, run it outside of Ethereum, and prove what the result is for 50 cents. You know, that would be the ideal goal.
Right, so the provability is really the challenge. Provability at low cost, not necessarily, mm-hmm. like, so for high security environments, would you say that it makes sense to just go ahead and incur the higher cost because you want to be able to actually execute the code in a secure environment?
Yeah, I mean, if you have to, yeah. There's also another technique called secure multi-party computation. And it's kind of like SNARKs, but instead of a zero-knowledge proof, what you do is you actually do the computations on the encrypted data. So you have some data that's encrypted or some data that's secret, and you do the computations on that instead. It's actually a bit cheaper in some instances, so that might be another route.
And under that model, is there a danger of the operations and their results exposing information about the encrypted block?
Not really. You know, but right now, all you can really do is add, subtract, multiply, and divide with it. So it's pretty, it's in its nascency.
Awesome. I think the next question that I had was actually about Ethereum, and there's a lot of doubt on it, but I also see a lot of excitement, and when I was in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, there was a lot of people that really took Vitalik's presentation to heart and really, you know, it's growing, let me put it that way, and there's a lot of people saying Bitcoin 2.0, other things similar to that. One of the other interesting things I've realized is when I was talking to someone there from Citigroup is that Citigroup is playing with Ethereum, the bankers. So I also think, you know, Augur's the first project completely based on it. And how much have the folks that are a part of the Ethereum project helping out Augur?
So quite a bit. So there's two things here. Yeah, a lot of people do doubt Ethereum. I actually used to be one of those people. I thought it was trying to do too much. I thought it was over complex, convoluted. I also thought, you know, the use cases were kind of interesting, kind of fun, but not really that practical. And then I started to look into it a lot more and realized that I was wrong. It is actually very useful. The reason it appears convoluted on the outside is they have three clients. And the reason they have these three clients is because if you make one client like Bitcoin, you have the problem of you have bugs. If you make three clients and they all have to use the same protocol and they're all in different programming languages, bugs are a lot less popular, for instance, because everything has to interoperate. So if you notice that one client has a bug, you'll find it in the other clients and fix them all. So that's, you know, kind of one of the reasons why Ethereum appears very complex on the outside, but it's actually a pretty smart strategy. And then as for whether they're working with us, so Vitalik works with us pretty closely. When we started, there were a few languages to write on Ethereum with. There was one called LLL, which is like Lisp. Basically, it has a bunch of parentheses in it. And then there was Serpent. And Serpent's basically a sort of Python-esque language. And Vitalik wrote Serpent. And so basically we started using Serpent to write our contracts. And now there's a new language called Solidity, but we haven't migrated to it or anything because we're already working with Vitalik. And you know, when we started, Solidity they haven't even picked the name for it then. And so Vitalik basically, he'll like add features for us if we ask him or things like that.
So do these languages coexist at the same time on the Ethereum blockchain?
So the way that works is you have these languages and they compile down. And so you take the code, you write it, and you basically, you know, do a command line command. And what happens is it converts it all into Ethereum opcodes. So you get to write in this nice high-level language. It's like a traditional programming language. It feels like a traditional programming language. But then it converts it into everything that Ethereum blockchain understands.
And I think, you know, the hype around Ethereum is what led to confusion. And I'm glad you actually spoke on that, because that's really something where, you know, I'm not as familiar with others, but I know enough people that are way smarter than me about those kind of things that have spoken very highly of Ethereum. And I'm a big fan of the most intelligent thing you can do is admit you don't know and talk to smarter people than you. I think that works very well. And one of the people that were smarter than me that I met, and I want to get a little more into the decentralized, or I should say the prediction market theory, was Robin Hanson. I spoke about him last week when he was at the house with us. And his, you know, Overcoming Bias blog and his entire basis of using prediction markets to make governmental or any kind of decisions, really, because those that are predicting the decisions have a financial stake in it. Is this something that, you know, Augur thought very highly of, was saying, okay, this may be a way that we can improve everything from international relations to contracts to a lot of other things? And, you know, other things would just be, you know, not just that, but how would a prediction contract work, and how would this ability to use the crowd's wisdom and their financial backing to make a better decision or predict a better decision really be executed? And what examples would there be of things like this that have happened?
Yeah, so we love Hanson's work. He's basically, you know, Hayek wrote about prediction markets a bit in the 40s. He didn't call them that. He didn't really flesh it out. Hanson was the one who did all that. He started in the early 90s. He actually brought them into academia, and now there's, you know, a whole journal for prediction markets. And so we love Hanson's work. As for how a prediction market actually works, well, basically what you do is you propose a question. We can go through two examples. We can go through one example that's, you know, more along Hanson's work, and we can also ask another question that's more, you know, say, normal. So let's start with a normal example. You have, say, an election, a presidential election, and you want to figure out which person's going to win the party nomination. So you say, you know, will it be, you know, Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney, whatever. And you have two sets of shares. You have Mitt Romney shares and you have Jeb Bush shares. Now, you can buy and sell these on the open market. And so let's say I want to buy some Jeb Bush shares. Let's say the current price for a Jeb Bush share is 60 cents. So if it's 60 cents, that means the market thinks there's a 60% chance that Jeb Bush is going to win the nomination. Now, since that's 60 cents, the Romney share should be 40 cents because they have to add up to a dollar. Because if I pick Jeb Bush and I buy a bunch of shares at 60 cents and I'm right and he does win the nomination, I'll get a dollar for each share that I own. Now, so that's like a pretty common use case of prediction markets. That's what Intrade did basically all the time, elections. However, you can get some really more interesting things, which Hanson talks about all the time, you know, things like futurarchy in business decisions. So a cool example for that is you're a government and you want to pass a bill. Let's say it's the stimulus plan. Back in 2009, I think they did that. So you have the stimulus plan, and you want to figure out, will the stimulus plan lower unemployment? Will it increase the GDP? And you can also ask questions like, does it make more sense to spend our stimulus plan money on the things that are allocated, or would it be better if we just put all the money to public infrastructure? And so you can ask these two questions, and you can basically have a set of shares. You'll have shares that combine, you know, whether we use the money for the current stimulus plan, or if we use it for infrastructure, right? And so you have these sets of shares, and you can figure out what the public thinks the best outcome is. And whatever the public thinks the best outcome is, that's what the government chooses. That's Hanson's idea. It's called futurarchy. It's never really been done, but it could easily be done with a project like Augur. Whether the government will listen to our predictions or not, I don't know.
So what is it that, you know, you're excited about? What are you going home and, you know, when you're not working on Augur at your day job, right? Like, when you're going home, what are you building? What do you want to build on top of this prediction market?
So I guess for me, I'd like to build, after it's out, I'd probably like to build some nice UIs for it. You know, it's one of the type of project like this, the UI can really make it or break it. So I like to have UIs that have a search engine in them. You can search for markets. Because this gets really popular, you're going to have all this junk to sort through, and you need to be able to organize it. So I think I would probably write a search engine for Augur.
So speaking of that, how do you think other platforms and maybe other projects not related to prediction markets might actually use some of the infrastructure you're building for this project? And who do you think sort of your users and developers will be in this early stage?
So, let's see, users. So we'll have people who, you know, want to make money because they think they're right more often than other people. They'll buy outcomes they think they know more about. That's like the classic prediction market use case. However, there's lots of other weird ones. Like, let's say you're a business and you wanted to decide which project to launch or which product to even start building. You can ask a prediction market, and they can give you a pretty accurate estimate. HP did this a lot. They asked internal employees which product they thought they should build. Sometimes they didn't actually listen to them, and they ended up being proven wrong. And so this makes upper-level management pretty angry, actually. And so a lot of companies quit using prediction markets for these reasons. However, with something like Augur, what you could do is, instead of asking your internal employees that question, you could actually ask your actual customers, who likely know better about what product they want to buy than your employees do. That's one example. Another thing you can do is you can basically just use the data for anything. So we have this Oracle system, right? And it allows you to basically ask a question, and the oracles will report what happened. So you can use that for anything. You can ask a question about anything. You can also use the results of that to, say, power your own prediction market if you want to make, you know, a separate UI, a separate app, or whatever. You could use the results from that to power it. Lots of things like that.
When I was in San Francisco, we had a conversation about Bayesian statistics, and I was a bit curious how you got introduced to the idea. It was something where when I was introduced, like most, I think Nate Silver did it for me, where I kind of read and saw the accuracy and thought, you know, there's a lot to this, and it's funny because the other thing that I would say is when you read a blog like Less Wrong, and I saw this on a Reddit post very recently about how a lot of people thought it was very condescending, the tone and the language. And I'm like, no, in the title, it's the least condescending thing ever, Less Wrong. Like, that to me is a perfect way to describe it. What in this do you like, and how were you introduced to Bayesian statistics, and how do you think, you know, Augur fits into that?
So I think I was introduced to Nate Silver as well. I read about him in the 08 election. And the way I see it fitting in is, so prediction markets don't care how you get your information. So basically, you can have people in our markets who buy outcomes based on what Nate Silver says. And that's just another method of incorporating information. And so things about Bayesian statistics are, it's very good for computing certain things. You can predict elections really well with Bayesian statistics. You can predict baseball games with it. You can't predict things like, will this drug get approved by the FDA? Or, you know, will cold fusion be successful within the next 5 years? You can't get any estimate at all from Bayesian statistics for that. And that's where prediction markets are really powerful. What was the second half of your question?
It was more about, you know, how you were interested in it, which you pretty much answered, and, you know, just what the uses are, and really, you know, how is this something that basically, you know, influenced Augur. And I guess as a follow-up to the follow-up, and the Nate Silver issue is, one of the oft-heard quotes is he's one of the only folks that can actually outperform prediction markets, which I think is telling. I think, and that's really actually an important thing, and I don't think it's a bad thing for prediction markets, because I think that most people that do participate in the prediction market do not have the ability to compute and know which things they should be buying shares in versus, you know, really open-ended questions with tons of outcomes and inputs. And, you know, I think that's really something quite brilliant, and it's something that's really understated. And that's one of the reasons I joined the Augur team as well. I'm a big fan of this idea. And really something, one of my sore spots is education and the overuse of statistics in education. I think it's awful because there's so many outputs and it's resulting in really poor results. And no one's taking a step back and looking like, okay, how are we using this? Why does this work in baseball? Why does this not work in education? Why doesn't this work in government? Why doesn't this work here? And it's really simple, I thought. Like, I thought the entire premise was very simple. It was what, you know, do you have an ability to have a somewhat accurate prediction or, you know, a very good likelihood versus something that there's not enough information to make that decision about? And it really, you know, it's telling to me that, you know, this mindset is growing. And that he is the one that is, you know, outperforming that market also means that those who are using these statistical methods will be the most likely to have a financial gain in making decisions, so they would even make this more more impressive, more accurate. So imagine if, you know, Nate Silver and the top 20 Bayesian statisticians buy shares on one certain outcome, you know, it really would have a better chance and it would be more accurate than the crowd, the general crowd, the folks that just want to make a bet for $5 because it's fun. And, you know, that was when I heard a lot of things said about how Nate Silver does better and outperforms prediction markets. I go, well, that makes sense. Like, I think that completely makes sense to me. And that's really what you were saying earlier about what prediction markets can do and where they're most useful and where they're least useful. Mm-hmm. And it really is an interesting thought, an interesting way to look at things. And tell me how right or wrong I am on what I just said, because I always, yeah, like I said earlier, I like hearing people smarter than me and tell me that was wrong, this was right. Is this something, is that how I would explain it to, you know, my grandma? That's really how I would explain this thing, because a lot of people are very leery of statistics, statisticians. You know, people don't like those darn statistics because people are making decisions on them, when in reality, a lot of decisions are better with statistics. Some we don't have. This is what this product's for.
Yeah, so with regards to Nate Silver, basically, Nate himself says that a prediction market with, you know, about 2 or 3 times more volume than Intrade would actually be more accurate than me, referring to Nate Silver. And that's pretty powerful, because even the guy whose entire job is, you know, about making Bayesian predictions says that prediction markets are more accurate if they have sufficient volume. And that's a really powerful part about prediction markets. They don't care how you got your information. And the other thing is, you know, even if you have people betting $5 and they're kind of random idiots who don't know anything, for instance, the cool thing about what prediction markets are based on, which is the wisdom of the crowd, is if you have a bunch of random people and they're betting on something and they're kind of dumb, their lies or their inaccuracies will kind of even out. They don't really matter that much, but whatever the true outcome is kind of comes to the surface. It's like when you have criminals and there's actually an interesting Less Wrong post about this, but it's when you have criminals and they lie, their stories don't add up. But it's much easier if you get the truth out of them, because those stories almost always correspond.
So, Joey, how do you get your sufficiently large crowd? How do you get your sufficiently random sample for this? How is Augur going to be adopted as this product moves forward, really kind of by a sufficiently variated segment of society? So you're not just getting, you know, the predictions of the tech sappy. You're getting predictions of, you know, the idiot with $5 as well as Nate Silver.
Right. So one way we're raising awareness is we're doing a crowd sale of the stuff you use, it's called reputation, to actually report on the outcomes of events. So after an event happens, a centralized party generally would just say, this happened, here's your money. In our system, we have thousands of nodes. Each node reports what happens. So we're doing a crowd sale for that mechanism. And so that will build awareness. But then after that, we pretty much just have to grow organically. You know, prediction markets are, they tap into a very primal thing, which is people like to be right, and they like to wager money on whether they're going to be right or not. And so I think we'll you know, immediately see lots of markets on things like elections. The hard part will be getting markets on things that matter even more than that. You know, markets about products, which product's going to be more successful, markets about government decisions, those things will be a harder sell.
Okay, one of the things that we like to do is sort of ask if there's anything, you know, personal or side projects that you're working on that you want to plug, that you want to share with our listener and our audience. What have you got? And I think we're going to bring it to a close afterwards.
Okay. So nothing too intense right now, side project wise. I do have the point of sale I was working on for Bitcoin. It's called Murray Post. It's basically point of sale where you can buy things using Bitcoin if you have a Bluetooth Bitcoin wallet. The problem with point of sales in Bitcoin right now is they all use QR codes. And if you ever bought anything from a store with a QR code, it's pretty clunky. With Bluetooth, you just walk up, you pull your phone out, and the cash register rings you up, and it will ask, do you want to pay this much money to this person? You tap yes or tap no, then you're done.
And you know what? I actually had one more question before we wrap up, and this is something we talked about a little off air. Explain your experience in basically performing the first Bitcoin transaction using sound. That fascinated me, and it was very interesting. So can you just speak a little bit on that?
Sure. So the way I did that was you basically take a transaction, Bitcoin transaction, and you convert it into zeros and ones, because you can do that with anything. Any data you can convert into binary. So you convert it into zeros and ones, and then what you do is you basically envelop these zeros and ones into a wavelength. And the high frequency you make it be a 1, a low frequency you make it be a 0, and you use a speaker and a microphone, and the microphone on the other side listens, and when it hears a high frequency, it takes a 1, low takes a 0, and then it converts it back into the transaction text, and then it broadcasts it to the Bitcoin network. And I did that with just 2 smartphones.
Very neat, very neat. And is there any social media or besides Augur.net, Augur Project on Twitter, what social media would you like to plug as well?
That's about it. There's also Augur Project on Facebook. But our website's the main thing. You sign up for our newsletter on Augur.net. You can get, you know, updates about the project, things like that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Joey. It's been a great episode of Decentralized. We look forward to seeing how the work proceeds with the Augur Project, and we look forward to talking to our listeners again next week.
Thanks for having me on.